Welcome to The Cherry Picker, the horror movie podcast where we like to kill people, but not really. I'm your host, Zach Cherry, and with me as always...
How do you think your God will touch you? Well, friends, now you know. When there is no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth. Eddie, the better it is truth.
That's not fair. That's a line from the original.
It's from both.
I know. Okay.
It's said by Ken Foray all over again.
It too. Is in a cameo. Dawn of the Dead, the remake, released March 19th, 2004.
Yeah.
I think this is the third remake we've covered on the podcast. The second one of which we did the original and now we're doing the remake.
Oh.
I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which remake did we precede the... Oh.
We did the...
House on Haunted Hill?
Okay, I guess there's four. Or five. There's a lot more. Never pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Amethyst Frost will know.
No, we've done... Okay, we've done the Dark Castle one. So we did 13 Ghosts. Yeah. We did House on Haunted Hill. We did House of Wax. But then we did a remake recently, which was My Bloody Valentine.
Oh. 3D. Right.
And I'm not sure if we've... I don't think we've done any others besides that.
Okay.
Anyway.
I'm zipping the lip. I'm not going to say...
Well, I wish you would, because... You know.
You're hilarious. Okay.
Anyway,
what were you going to say?
How you doing?
I'm great now. How are you, Zach Cherry?
I'm very well. It's been a minute since I've watched this one, so
yeah,
I was excited to watch it. And when we did the previous Dawn of the Dead, like the original Dawn of the Dead episode,
yes,
it kind of because that was reappraised for me. It was devaluated because I realized I didn't like it as much as I had initially liked it when I first saw it. And yeah. I was thinking, like, do I like the remake better? And,
right,
you know, that was sort of a question, like, whenever we cover that. And here we are today. So it's going to be something. I'm not sure yet.
Really?
Yeah. Because they're so different. And
they are.
And I think that's a testament to why this movie works, like, why, as a remake. And this is... Mm-hmm. I think this is, I mean, in terms of like when the remake machine really started in the early 2000s, because Texas Chainsaw Massacre was the one that kind of got the ball rolling. Like the Dark Castle ones were doing a different thing. Mm-hmm. And like I've said before, like those are remakes of movies from a bygone era. Like these are remakes of things that were still relatively contemporary at the time. Like this is 20 years ago from like the now when we're recording it, but like
sure,
even then, like 2004 and the original Dawn of the Dead came out in 1978.
Yeah.
So that's like 25 years, like, you know, well, around there. So that's like, you know, like us talking about Scream right now. So like when this came out, it was still pretty contemporary. And it's like a lot of the remakes that they were doing were horror movies that were still pretty contemporary.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But this isn't your father's, you know, fill in the blank, whatever horror movie
they're
remaking.
Yeah.
But and usually that's one thing actually that makes this one stand out also is I don't necessarily feel, and even after this most recent screening, that it kind of fell prey to what I would allude to as the trappings of a lot of the remakes of the early 2000s, which is, as we always say, like the gritty, you know, dark, like, you know, like kind of, I don't know, like desaturated kind of like aesthetic of so many of them. Like so many of them seem to be picking up from where the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake picked up, you know?
So. Yeah. Like the glossy, like the music video thing where everything's dark and gritty, but glossy and shiny. And
yeah, I mean, still this, very staged. Yeah.
This is directed by Zack Snyder and that's in your wheelhouse. Cause I don't really follow like superhero movies or anything. I've seen, Army of the Dead. We actually talked about it on a Patreon special thing that we did a while ago, like whenever that movie came out, because that's an old movie at this point. But I guess that was a spiritual sequel to this. And that movie's very like bright and colorful and flashy and fun. So it's kind of, I don't know if that is a Zack Snyder thing. Like, I haven't watched the Batman versus Superman.
Well,
it's not my thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we won't spend too much time on it, but it might bear some reference a little bit later. Yeah. I don't know where the conversation's going to take us here. But I will say, Zack Snyder, kind of notorious, actually, in his non-horror films, of which there are many, for, I think, leaning more in the opposite direction. The art direction is always kind of, like, praised, even by his heaviest critics, his heftiest, you know, critics. It does lean into a darker palette, not necessarily that of the horror remakes of the early 2000s, kind of like his own making. But because there is a lot of kind of like subdued color and a lot of shadows and a lot of that, and a general kind of, I guess, arguable malaise over the tone of the project. But yeah. So this movie really isn't a harbinger of things to come in a lot of ways. Yet, interestingly enough, I feel like the bleakness, and maybe this is what made so many people excited about him as a young filmmaker, the bleakness that we've kind of like aligned him with now, particularly with his superhero movies, I think really was a good fit for a zombie movie, because as we alluded to in our previous Dawn of the Dead 1978 discussion, this subgenre of horror is generally pretty bleak, is generally pretty hopeless, and generally kind of like, you know, dystopian. It's the end of things. And it's like, how do you carry on? Who can you trust? These are general themes and general questions that are brought up and asked repeatedly throughout these kinds of movies. And I think even though I think Zack Snyder represents it and examines it in a very different way than George A. Romero, shall we say, I still find validity in what he's presenting. And I think that's the general consensus in reaction to this movie, just specifically.
Yeah. It's a vision. And I feel that a lot of the other remakes that followed this, like there, you know, sometimes you'll have like a Rob Zombie, like he definitely had a vision for Halloween. But I think that a lot of the times it seemed like it was sort of like, and I don't want to say this with any disrespect, but I mean, I don't typically respect horror remakes, but I mean, it seemed like it was just like, let's just get like stock directors, you know, like anyone that we can just like throw on the payroll. You're going to be doing this. And Zack Snyder, I had to look this up because this is actually his first feature film as a director, which is pretty impressive. And I think that that's probably what gave way to his career, being like his first effort, because it showed like, okay, he's got range. He's not just kind of copying and pasting, but then just sort of like, you know, it's like, you know, copy the homework, but don't make it look obvious. He's doing his own thing with it. I don't know that he didn't write the script, but it's still like,
James Gunn wrote the script, another comic book, for people who may not know James Gunn, Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah. And interestingly enough, Zack Snyder, kind of like the bastion of, you know, the DCEU, the past 10 years or so, James Gunn is picking up and doing his own take now that we're moving into another direction.
It's interesting that we're talking about all this comic book stuff, because I mean, I don't remember everything that we spoke about during the original Dawn of the Dead episode, but I seem to recall there was something, we had a conversation about how there had kind of like a comic booky tone to it, like especially with like the bright colors. So it feels almost serendipitous that, you know, Zack Snyder and James Gunn would make something like this and then go on to kind of have the, like, being names in like the superhero film realm, because it is all very comic booky when you connect all these things in the Dawn of the Dead world. I guess just what I wanted to say is like, well, you know, Dawn of the Dead, it has that vision. It kind of, that's what elevates it higher than most of the remakes for me, because I think this is, I'm still trying to figure out if I like this one better than the original, but it's definitely, it's still a remake that I think is good. I think it's like it warranted, you know, if that was the story that they were telling, this is who they brought on to do it, it warranted remaking it, where I feel like a lot of the shit that was just being shoveled out after that, like, you know, like Prom Nights, the remake, where, like, and that's a completely different story from the original, but just like, why? what is this bullshit? Like, why, we're just, throwing a name attached to an IP or just sure. like just so we can keep it going. And this is an example of something that works.
I mean, and it certainly was successful. And I remember even I saw this in the theater in 2004. And I remember being excited. Like, I was fully prepared for it to suck. And especially after seeing George A. Romero's, which I actually needed more time with to fully appreciate. Mm-hmm. But I thought, oh, okay, I get it. And then I went to go see this thinking like, okay, so they're probably going to, you know, it's probably... And interestingly enough, the things that I thought I wasn't going to like turned out to come true, but they seemed to work for me. Like, I thought, okay, it's probably going to be like, you know... much more streamlined. It's probably going to look like it has a little bit more of a budget behind it. It's going to look less kind of like indie and, you know, like DIY or DIY, you know, kind of like, you know, because I mean, there is something about George A. Romero's that does feel very kind of like homemade and very, you know, hands-on. Whereas, and this one does feel sleeker and does feel like there's maybe more quote unquote production behind it. But, none of that seemed to detract from it. I didn't feel like they were trying to distract me from what the substance they weren't showing me with like a lot of flashy effects and things like that. The effects all seemed incredibly visceral and connected. And I mean, there's no other way to put it, human, which is always the hardest thing for me when I watch a zombie movie, like, because it can be so dire and so, you know, hopeless. It's sometimes hard for me to hitch my wagon to, you know, those stories and go along with them because it's just so depressing, unless it's got a sense of humor about it or unless there's some kind of like social commentary. And I feel like this has both. I feel like there's at least three strong turn on a dime humorous moments that happen where something is incredibly intense and then flips on its side and cuts to something that is meant to make us laugh. And they actually all work for me. And So
yeah, the storytelling and the flow of everything works really well. And I think that that definitely is a testament to like why this still 20 years later is a very rewatchable film. Yeah. So before we get into it and we do a premise, I just want to chat about a little Patreon stuff. So first of all, if you are supporting the podcast, if you've been listening to the podcast and think we're all right, we think you're pretty cool too, but we really appreciate any support you can get. So you can head over to my Patreon, Zach Cherry, Z-A-C-K-C-H-E-R-R-Y. You're supporting both the podcast and my main YouTube channel. But with that, you get early access to all of our Cherry Picker episodes. If you're supporting on the Freddy Krueger tier, you'll get access to the Cherry Picker After Dark, which is the bonus episode we do once a month. This month, we are doing, again, Survivor Final Girls, because we just have so much fun with it. And like, I'm addicted to Survivor, and I think that I've kind of made a fan out of you.
It's fun to get the references and kind of like go on the ride, and particularly like this fantasy football kind of like spin we've put on it with our final girl.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's because, I mean, it's just melding two things together that are so special to me, like horror movies, final girls, and you know, Survivor, reality television, and just putting them in there. But if you want to check it out, there's on YouTube or even, you know, streaming, you can listen to the first hour of the one we did back in February. We also did the Scream, with like three seasons of Scream Survivor. So we've done quite a few now, but it's a lot of fun. And everyone who is a Patreon member who got to see it, their feedback was pretty positive. So I think a lot of people enjoyed it, and they're bigger episodes too. If you don't mind listening to us, you know, prattle on for.
For
double episodes. So there's that going on. That is available to all the Freddy Krueger tier members. You get access to all of the back catalog. There's like 22 previous episodes at this point. You know, having said that, I do want to welcome some new Patreon supporters. So give it up to Sienna, Joshy. There's a lot of Y's on the end. Horror by Jordy, and Dylan Reeves. So thank you very much to all of the new Patreon supporters. And starting with this episode, because, you know, I really want to honor our top tier supporters who have, like, whether they've been with us for a while or, you know, just every month, you know, giving such a large contribution. So I want to make sure that they're getting recognized. So every episode now, I'm going to be thanking all these folks. So to our Michael Myers supporters, the Michael Myers tier, thank you to Kyle Beard, Sam Levy, Khalil Young, Brady James, Ali Hamouche, Shane Allingham, Tim McKay, Stephanie Starbright, Horror Slut 95, Iggy Zanetta, Sean Flanagan, Josh Carr, Michael Boswell, Brandy Beebe, and our top tier Ghostface supporters. I want to say thank you to Eric Champney, Daniel Saturn, Tamika Jones, and Garrison Nichols. So thank you very much.
Yay, everybody.
Thank you to all Patreon supporters. You're keeping this wheel turning. We're at over 100 episodes now, and yeah. I mean, we wouldn't have had that momentum or steam if it wasn't for the support that we get over on Patreon. So thank you very much. And if you are interested, if you do love the podcast, if you love us, if you love Edward and hate me, or vice versa, you know, go over
there. Absolutely.
There's a few. I've seen them.
I've heard them.
Yeah. all the support we love. So thank you very much. Yeah. And also a huge thank you to Boy Cried Wolf, who edits all of this together, and another valuable member of the team that Absolutely. We couldn't do this without. So there we go. Let's hear the premise of Dawn of the Dead 04.
Okay. A nurse, a policeman, a salesman, a young couple expecting a child, and several other survivors of a worldwide plague all take refuge in a Midwestern U.S. shopping mall against crowds of aggressive, flesh-eating zombies who may well be ushering in an apocalyptic Dawn of the Dead.
Huh? Yeah, there we go. Does the trick, yeah. I want to say, starting out with this movie, really memorable opening scene, and I feel like we've seen this I've seen other movies like kind of copy this. I don't, maybe it's like one of the Resident Evils or something, but it's just like it always comes back to Dawn of the Dead. And I think that with the original Dawn of the Dead, because I remember opening and she's kind of having a nightmare, the Francine, the main character in that movie, and then you see like she's wakes up in the new studio and there's just like pandemonium going on around her. And I kind of like that this one is a little bit more, you know, subdued. Like we get, you know, for like a brief moment to just kind of experience life before all the shit hits the fan. And it's sort of like when you get that jarring shift, and I guess it's Anna, the main character here, played by Sarah Pauly, her husband, Yay. I'm assuming it's her husband. it's just like, it happens so rapidly that it's like, and we see that a lot throughout the movie where it just like, things are gone in the blink of an eye. It's just like yeah. something crazy will happen. It's just like, that's life. It's just like, here one second, gone the next. And it's really that's emphasized right. in here. And I feel like, especially in the opening scene with just like the chaos and her kind of like navigating through that in like however long this sequence is, just like, you know, everything's normal at work and just talking about like their plans and just like, oh yeah, I get like a 3-day weekend. And it just like something about it just really... Yeah. resonates even harder because of that, because it's just like everything is just like snatched away in a moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's in addition to this depiction, a very effective depiction of like these typical components of a daily practice. I also love how early, because I remembered this about the movie, like anytime I think about it, I always see a kind of brilliant, almost Secret of the Ooze, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle green hue. And it's present almost from the get-go when we're in that hospital with Sarah Paul's character, with Anna, when she's talking to her friend and talking to the doctor, who's just kind of like completely disrespecting her. And it made me realize, like, oh, that's present throughout this movie. Like, it follows her out of the hospital into like the lawns of the neighborhood as she's driving through. And then the only kind of manifestation of it inside her bedroom is, I think, the tank top she's wearing. And then later on, in the park where she encounters like the other people, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but then it's present on the walls in the common area mm-hmm. of the mall throughout the rest of the film. And it's always just kind of like got, I guess there's a chill to it, but I wouldn't exactly call it like, you know, cold like burr, but it's got an oddness to it. Like there's yeah. something strangely, like even against the backdrop of like the lawns and the foliage in the park when she encounters like the rest of this team that she's going to go through the rest of the movie with, it makes the natural look unnatural. Like there is no real comfort. Yeah. So there's a rigidity to the movie yeah. that I feel like is because the plague is already present at the top of this movie, even though we don't know what it is, we're seeing people like wheeled in on gurneys and things like that. It's almost like there is life, but there's also a presence. It's been invaded by something that probably seems, I mean, for lack of a better term, alien. And I mean that in terms of, again, like in a very comic book, 1950s kind of comic book, sci-fi, you know, three-eyed, you know, Toy Story alien kind
of. I mean, it also feels very like early pandemic sort of like where it's just like, there's something going on, but like, you know. We don't know yeah. what it is yet. And then just like all of a sudden it hits and it's just like craziness.
Very unmellow. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's unsettling. And that about
yeah. it. And I like that look for it because the movie has a very uniformed aesthetic to it. And again, like going back to just like what we're saying about how every remix sort of had this like grittiness, like the gritty polish that it felt like. They're all the same, you know, they're like nothing looked any different from the other, where this has that going for it. And I think for any movie, like especially a horror movie, the ones that I tend to glom onto and remember the most are the ones that have like a very distinct look. Like, you know, like look at anything that Argento does, like you look at Suspiria, yes. Or Tenebrae, or even like going to like Candyman and things like that. Right. Silence of the Lambs, like each one of those has an aesthetic that is so unique to itself. Like it looks like this is, you are now in the world of Dawn of the Dead 2004.
You talk about it all the time when we discuss anytime it comes up, the original Halloween trilogy, that John Carpenter, you know, 2:35:1 aspect ratio and how the characters occupy the space and even how the space is depicted. It seems very uniform in that vein as well.
I feel like the camera, like the ratio that they use is so integral because it can make or break a movie. I mean, I think that the most important thing is the script. I think that's probably, I mean, it's like there's an Alfred Hitchcock quote. Like, I think it's like the most important thing about a movie is the script, and the script. Or the three most important things about the movie are the script, and the script. So I would say like the script, like it has to be a good script, like by a large margin, that's the most important thing. And then you have like, the, you know, go into the visual aspects and the performances there within. But I think if, you know, if you think of your favorite horror movies, I think probably like just like anyone listening, just think of like your top three favorite horror movies. Like, why are those your favorite horror movies? And it probably has something to do with the script.
I mean, there's something to be said for that. Also, I mean, just to play devil's advocate for a second, and we won't linger on it because I think this script is pretty solid. But I also think it's found in the editing with this movie because there's so much to say. Okay. so one thing that I admire about film just in general is also just like the way you can kind of manifest something and capture it, and it's all about what happens in that room. The script will certainly help, and certainly like we just did in our last Patreon After Dark podcast, right, discussions of like our top 10 and the things that I in particular kept heralding as my favorite horror movies, or at least, you know, the top 10 in my rankings or whatever of what we've done so far, were ones where every cylinder was firing. And that means the script, that means the production team who designs, you know, in advance. That means, you know, the team that shoots it, the team that acts it, and the team that edits it. And then finally, like, you know, how it's delivered delivered, you know, to you. It means everybody did their job. But ultimately, what's interesting, and I want to bring this up when you were talking about the cuts of the original George A. Romero one. This one, I didn't realize until after I finished it, I saw the R-rated version of this. And there, I forgot on most, you know, physical media releases of this movie, it's presenting the unrated director's cut. And I even watched a discussion essay on the thing, and I saw a scene that I was like, oh, that wasn't in my cut. I saw the R-rated cut. So did you watch the unrated director's cut?
I have the Scream Factory Blu-ray.
So you have both cuts.
So it has both cuts. I put on specifically the unrated one. And every time I do this, like I think of you, because I know that you don't have as many movies as I do. Like a lot of the times you're streaming things or whatnot. And I'm just like, sure. I bet you anything he's would have watched the theatrical cut. And there might be like some sort of disconnect in our conversation. Because I actually don't know what scenes are the unrated, because I think I've only ever seen the unrated. I didn't see this in the theater. I've only ever owned like the DVD or the Blu-ray. Okay. But at the beginning, when you put on the unrated, there's sort of like a 1 minute, 2 minute intro by Zack Snyder, and he's just sort of talking about, you know, here's all like the just like extra bits of gore, yada yada yada. But we kind of, this completely went over our heads because we've been trying to get in the habit of announcing to people where they can watch these movies if they haven't seen them before. So if you have that information prepared, do you want to segue into that?
Yeah, right now, sure.
Yeah.
Okay, because I mean, I streamed this off of, originally it was on Netflix. It just got pulled, so don't look for it there. But who knows, maybe whenever you're watching this in the future, maybe they put it back. But it is currently available to stream at the time of this recording on Stars, that app, if you're subscribed to it. And it's also available for individual purchase and rental on the usual suspects, YouTube, Apple, and Prime. And I'm glad you brought up the physical media, because the second most recent was the Scream Factory Collector's Edition that dropped October 2017. For Blu-ray solely, both cuts, and it received a 4-star rating on Blu-ray.com. And also, incidentally, a Blu-ray combo with Land of the Dead, which is fun if you want a little George A. Romero versus Zack Snyder going on. Or another Blu-ray combo with Land of the Dead and The Thing, which I actually thought about The Thing when I was watching this one. I didn't think about it.
Well, he produced it.
Right, but I didn't.
The 2011 Thing.
No, this is the original The Thing.
Okay, well, that's even harder. Yeah.
No, but it just kind of made me think when I was watching this particular one, I was like, oh, it's another kind of like strangers in a thrown into the mix with each other and everything like that. Maybe because there's many more strangers for a much longer time in this particular iteration of Dawn of the Dead than in the original.
Yeah.
In the original, it's kind of like our core four, and those are the ones we really glom onto, you know?
Yeah.
But with this one, it did make me think about The Thing, and I was like, oh, another example of just kind of strangers, for the most part, thrown into the mix with each other in a situation that I think actually works. Take that, Agatha Christie. But the most recent edition of physical media that's available, it did get a 4K release collector's edition in January of 2023 that includes the theatrical cut on Blu-ray. And that one got a 4.5-star rating out of 5 on Blu-ray.
So the director's cut is 4K.
Yeah, the director's cut is
4K. But not the theatrical.
The theatrical is only available on the Blu-ray.
Oh, that's so weird. What are you going to do?
I think that's
the thing. I would have to go back and watch them side by side. And I don't know, like, I don't need to watch this again right away. But just to see, or I could look online, just like, what are the extra scenes? Do the extra scenes sort of like slow the pace down or, you know, things like that? Or are they absolutely needed?
Because I checked out also deleted scenes, because those are usually available. Someone always, you know, uploads those for particularly like a popular, you know, title like this one. And I was watching the deleted scenes, and they all seemed to be things that would have slowed it down. And I was like, I think these are things that might have just remained deleted. I don't know if there are things that were reinfused, because there was one thing that was not included in this run of deleted scenes, allegedly, that I saw in this video essay, which was I don't even know his name, but the old man speaking to the two security guards who were basically, you know, being held captive.
The gay guy who's trying to...
Who starts suggesting, like, when he knew he was gay and stuff like that. That was not in the theatrical cut. Okay. And I had forgotten about that. And while I was watching it, I was just kind of like...
Wasn't that part of the montage of just sort of, like, showing everyone, like, kind of acclimating to the mall life after however many weeks?
Not in the theatrical cut, but apparently it was part of the unrated director.
So that montage doesn't exist in the...
The montage does.
But that's what I'm asking you. It's just that they don't show everything.
The montage is much more peaceful, and it's much more... You just kind of see people getting on. We don't really focus. For a long time in the theatrical release, we kind of abandon the security guards and just kind of know, oh, they're in the background. I don't want to learn about them anyway, was the attitude I got as a viewer this particular screening, so...
Yeah, but I don't know if I. Then I probably would prefer the director's cut, because I liked kind of like checking, like giving everyone equal footing. Because I mean, even though like Anna is sort of like the lead, or like, you know, like she's the final girl, as it were, I feel like she, like everyone, kind of gets at least like equal. Like I don't do the Scream Time analysis or anything, like that's a Ryan Showers thing, but I instinctively, like watching things, you're just like, okay, we're at least getting it's almost like the, not the quantity of screen time that we get from characters, but the quality of screen time that we know that they're there. Like it's again, like going back to Scream, the fact that, you know, Matthew Lillard and Jamie Kennedy are barely in most of the movie, but just the scenes that they do appear in, they make an impact that you remember those characters. And, you know, you go back and you're like, oh, I thought that they were there way more than they actually were. So for all I know, I mean, Anna might be in like almost all the scenes, are just showing up there, but she doesn't have to like operate on a level that everyone else is operating on. Like when they're there, like, look at me, I'm a character in this, and I'm like way more interesting than Anna, because she's kind of, you know,
Well, yeah, she's our gateway in for sure. So I mean, that, you know, that just kind of feels like, oh, okay, so I guess you're the protagonist. But then once we all get into the mall, at least in the theatrical release, it does feel largely kind of subjective, and it does just kind of feel like everybody's kind of taking their moment. Everybody's kind of got their time to expose. And there are some characters who actually wish I could have gotten to know even better, like sweet Norma, the older lady who makes the discovery about the baby and everything.
Well, my favorite was the one with the bouncy curls, the blonde one.
Oh, of course she was.
Well, I don't even, she has a name, but it's never mentioned in the movie, but she's just sort of like, I think the moment that endeared me the most to her is when is it Nicole, the redhead, like, it's just like, what's the dog's name? The dog's name?
I don't remember. Who cares?
But let's just say Skip. She's like, Skip, Skip. And then the bounty blonde, she's like, Skip, Skip. Like, just mocking her. Because it's like, no, but I'm there. Because it's just like, that girl, it's like, she puts them in danger. So I'd be like, oh, yeah, she doesn't like this idiot who is like, has total disregard for everyone else's well-being. Oh, absolutely. God. That is the person. Listen, if I'm in that scenario, if I'm in the mall with those people, I would team up with her. Like, we would be friends. We would be shit talking the other people. Or, I mean, maybe I would be her. Who knows?
Was there a kind of like verifiable ratio that you felt intrinsically in your spirit as you were watching the movie, that was like from like a balance between like the likable characters and the unlikable characters, or did the scales tip in one particular direction?
See, that's the thing. Like, there's not really, there are unlikable characters, but I feel like you said, everyone gets their moment, and the ones who kind of start off maybe, you know, being not as well liked kind of do come back. Cause like even the, Ty Burrell, is that the actor's name?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause he has a lot. Cause he's,
As Steve.
Is that his name? Yeah. Sorry. He, cause at the end he's, he says something to Terry. Because I just, like, I think he's just sort of, like, again, mocking. He's just, like, we're risking our lives because, like, to go after his, like, stupid dead girlfriend or whatever. Just the characters who are just stating the obvious. And it's, like, that endears me to them. Even though they're, like, they're schmucks, like, at the end when they, you know, he just sort of leaves the bus and just, like, fuck all y'all. You know, that's kind of a dick move. But, I mean, there's so much that to get from all the characters that I'm just like, oh, I kind of like you in this scene. I'm kind of with you in what you're saying. Cause he's a character, like he's a D-bag, but he's just like, so what? Like he owns it, you know? And then relax. But then there's the security guard. What's his face? Like the main one who's kind of like the antagonist for the first act of the movie, or at least the first half. And then he kind of comes into his own in the end, and he's just sort of like, okay, I'm working with these people. I've kind of like put aside my ego and the differences and my need to be in charge and like letting them do their things. And he ends up saving them at the end. So like everyone kind of, everyone, you know, really gets something. And even if they're not as likable or they do things that piss me off, I still feel like there's enough presented out of them that's just like, I see a person in there. Like, these aren't just stock characters. Like, everyone feels real for the most part.
Okay. I mean, as usual, I'm glad that we're returning to form here with this movie because, as per usual, I agree with you, but in a different way. I'm going to say what you say, but in a completely different way.
Oh, yeah.
Because my attitude toward Nicole in particular, just starting at that particular character, yes, it was annoying that she, like, you know, kind of, like, absconded, is that the word that I'm using? Or just kind of, you know, like, left, abandoned them and kind of got in that big old truck that they all, you know, found themselves, like, you know, going to the mall in the first place to drive across a parking lot to save a dog that didn't need to be saved because the zombies aren't going to go after the dog. And, you know, to basically go on a death mission and leave an open door and get, you know, basically, like, attacked by, you know, a guy who was turning into a zombie himself. So, That said, as I was watching, I found myself feeling, I don't know if it's empathy or sympathy, I don't know what it was, but I was feeling like an understanding as to her particular, I guess her point of view in this particular moment, because I thought like, okay, well, the poor girl, her father got executed, like, she obviously didn't want it to happen. I really actually kind of, my heart went out to her when she left and hid. And actually, I really was happy with the way that was happened as far as exposing us to, like, the way characters are dealing with multiple characters with the situation. The fact that the security guards are like, come on, let us out, and everything like that. And what's his name? The good one? I forgot his name already. Terry,
played by, is it Kevin Zegers?
Yes.
Frozen fame. Well, he's in Frozen, but also him and Nicole, played by Lindy Booth, they were both in Wrong Turn, which we covered. They played the couple in, like, the first couple that got killed, like the ones that, like, the ear. Remember that shit? That's them. So this is, like, really fun. Like, we were a couple in that movie, and now here we are faring a lot better, you know, like until the end.
They made it to the end credits. Yeah. But this is the thing. I loved watching Terry, like, kind of, like, shush them and just kind of, like, you know, watch the, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
The monitor.
Security camera.
Yeah.
Yeah. The, you know, like, just seeing her. Why there's a security camera, like, behind a counter. Oh, I guess behind a counter because you need it because in case I get robbed. Okay, that makes sense. Sorry. But just watching her just kind of, like, huddle back there and, you know, because of something that's going on off screen for her. And and juxtaposing that against, like, her father, like, sitting there dealing with this impending zombifying that they know is coming. He can feel it. And he's saying things to the point where I can't even kind of, like, recognize what he's saying. But it doesn't matter because he's just letting it go. He's just, you know, he's just kind of relishing, I guess, the last moments of consciousness as himself that he's going to have. Mm-hmm. And then we hear that. And even that was another moment that I loved, just like the moment where Michael goes to Anna and she's just kind of like something like, I don't remember what the exact line was, but it was something like, I'm glad you didn't you know, go through with it, or I yeah. knew you wouldn't go through with it, something like that. And he just kind of stands there silently, and then you hear, ah! And then you hear the gunshot, yeah. and everybody knows what happens. And then that's a jump cut. That's one of those yeah. cuts that I talked to about, like, now, oop-da, yeah. cool kid, or something like that, you know, like where there's a pop yeah. song playing and people are just kind of like getting on yeah. with their lives.
Yeah, no, I just, the lyrics were something like, go on, get down with the sickness, or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. yeah. It was just an upbeat, like, song. It wasn't like Boy from New York City, like yeah. I was just singing, but it may as well have been.
It wasn't like the April Fool's Day one. Too bad you're crazy.
Blah, yeah, blah, right. Oh my god, that would have been funny yeah. too. I mean, you could put anything there, and it'd probably be like yeah. ironic in a humorous way. But mm-hmm. the reason I'm bringing it up for Nicole is like I had an affinity for her at that particular moment, and that followed through the rest of the movie. I thought, like, okay, yes, it's a stupid move that she took this truck and, you know, went off to go rescue a dog that didn't need saving, but. If that dog is kind of like the last, her father was the last link after she lost the rest of her family, and then she just lost him. Now she's developed a connection with this dog and with this new boy. The mm-hmm. dog has run away. She was flipping out because she didn't want to see it lowered into like all those monsters. So there's something irrational that is already yeah. at play with her. She's not thinking in terms of like what the actual stakes are. She's just no. seeing this thing that I connected with, this thing that I love,
yeah.
that loves me, is going to be gone if I don't do something about it. Nobody else cares.
Well, I don't,
I have to do something. And it's a delusion, but it's an understandable delusion. So yeah. it doesn't make me arm's length.
I don't have an issue with the movie for her doing that. and I'll make a comparison to like the other Zack Snyder movie, but no, like it's irrational, and it just makes me roll my eyes and just be like, you asshole, why would you do that? But I like, but that's what I'm talking about. Like even like characters like that, you know, you can have a character who just does something stupid and you just get pissed off because they're like, oh, that's the stock character doing their stupid thing. But in this case, because we are endeared to her, like we do see sort of like this, like their relationship, that couple, and just sort of like, you know, from the beginning, and him like watching her in that private moment on the monitor, and you know, all the way up until like when they're getting into the trucks and he wants to be in the same truck as her, and they're just like, no time, move, and like you know you get a sense of who these people are. They feel real. Sure. And that's what I appreciate. It's like they could have easily yeah. just made her an annoying idiot, and she's an annoying idiot, maybe even not annoying, but like I understand her, like I have empathy for her, and that's
sure.
that's what makes the characters in this better. The juxtaposition, and I don't really want to spoil Army of the Dead too much, but let's just say the person who survives that movie is yeah. the person who, like, it's like that entire movie is like predicated around a mission, we'll just say, and mm-hmm. yeah. and this person who survives it has nothing to do with that, and they have an agenda of their own, and they fuck everything up for everyone, and everyone yeah. basically is affected by that by the end, and this person is yeah. okay. Nothing has happened to them. And I hated that so much. It pissed me off. And I feel like that, like being a, like both Zack Snyder movies and sort of like spiritually connected in the sense mm-hmm. that like they're of the dead movies. I think that it was handled way more successfully here with that character than it was in mm-hmm. Army of the Dead.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with you there. Also, okay, just to reference two other people you brought up, I think Monica is the blonde that you brought up, the one who was.
Of course her name is Monica, you know.
The one who was annoyed by Nicole. I think she might have been like one of my, I mean, she got the least screen time, at least in my cut,
yeah.
That, you know, of any character that, you know, or at least let's say the least kind of like sympathetic to my eye,
yeah.
because all I saw her do was make a really bad choice by getting fucked by Ty Burrell's character Steve, and then you know,
when she's trying on the lingerie,
right? Trying yeah. on the lingerie and starts and also like openly mocks a girl who's only, you know, only one of only two remaining connections is this dog. and then what's the only other thing that she does? She gets sawed by the old yeah. gay man who wasn't gay in my cut or who didn't come out in my cut.
Well, because she's, they're in the truck at the end and she's like, you got to go faster, man. And then it's like, he does. And then she just like kind of gets whirled around and then the salt goes into her. She's the least defined character of anything. Like, we don't know her name other than like in what it says in the credits. We don't know anything about her, but there's still like in those moments, it's just like, oh, this is who that would be. Like, I see her. She would be like the Anya or the Cordelia character
say, don't say that.
No.
Oh my God.
You get off your fucking high horse and just accept the fact that there
Anya
is
and Cordelia got the opportunity several times over to provide even their honesty.
What did you need this movie to be 3 hours long? Okay. Like,
no, I didn't need it to be 3 hours long, but it would have been interesting if they could have thrown in one or two things to just kind of make her seem, because that's the thing with the Ty Burrell character with Steve. I felt like for the most of the movie, I was like, I actually thought about Cordelia, just kind of thinking like, God, it'd be nice if his honesty was at any point somewhat redeeming, or if he could even be kind of like the childs of the group, that as in the only one who's willing to stand his ground and, you know, say, but this is what's wrong with that plan, you know, in a necessary way. I never felt like his snide remarks were a helpful component of the conversation. I always felt like he was the one who wanted to do the absolute least, kind of like the other protagonist in Army of the Dead, who was just kind of like the most selfish and the one who, even though he paid a price, there was only one redeemable thing about him, and it was barely redeemable in my cut anyway, which was when they were in their respective vehicles, and he had a saw and he was going after cutting off the limbs of, like, you know, the zombies who were climbing onto the vehicle like they had planned. I was like, oh wow, he actually did something finally. And even that wasn't enough to redeem him in my eyes. I just thought, well, at least you're not completely useless.
Okay.
You've done one thing to help.
I agree that there's a level of just like, okay, if you're just going to be your character and, like, you know, just for the sake of being your character when it doesn't really need to be there. Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of moments like that. But I don't need characters to redeem themselves. Like, that's the thing. And we've talked about this before. I don't need them to be sympathetic. I don't need them to be redeemable. I just have to know who they are. And I feel like despite the fact that, like, he's not being helpful and not in a helpful way that really is showing us, you know, what his agenda is, in a way that probably would have worked more cohesively with the story that they were telling. And, you know, same with her and just, you know, like getting anything from her. I still know who she is. I still think, like, okay, she's the one who's probably like really sarcastic and shit talking people. And, you know, she was hanging out with like the older lady who was like chain smoking and stuff like that. You know, I felt like there was a camaraderie there and I liked these people. And I just, like, you know, everyone kind of played their role. And yes, it probably could have been done a little bit more successfully, but I didn't need any more from, like, that character. I mean, it would have been nice, the bouncy blonde Monica.
Blonde Monica. That should be her full character name.
Yeah.
Because it fits. I know if you'd say that and I didn't even know her name, I'd know who you were talking about.
That
girl.
Yeah.
But, no, and that's the thing. It's not a criticism. It's not an indictment of the writing. Because I also know that there was, I don't remember who did the revisions. I know that at least passed through one other screenwriter's hands, even though James Gunn is credited. I know there's another writer who did some revisions on it, and I don't even know what was revised. But, it's not so much an indictment of that as it is just like, but I really positively responded to even the characters who are likable. I liked seeing them be unlikable or even contradict their characters in a way that didn't feel like bad writing or ignorance on the part of the screenwriters. It felt more like dimension added to characters that otherwise would have been cardboard cutouts and just be kind of like, I think about Michael in particular, spent so much of his opening moments, right into the mall, being kind of like the gentle soul, the one with the compassionate voice, the one who's like telling, hey, wait, we can't, you know, that kind of, benevolent force, in the group that I was like, well, listen to this guy. Okay. I like this guy.
What's the actor?
The actor is, I'm gonna get it for you in just a second. His name was Jake Weber.
So Jake Weber, and there were like scenes where it just like his voice sounded so familiar. And I was just like, I was like closing my eyes because it was like, who is this? And I kept hearing Liev Schreiber.
Oh.
I don't know what it is. It's just like in certain scenes, it's just like, is that Liev? No, but it's just like, because we did, and then like in Valentine, remember when What's-Her-Face, the heavy friend was like talking at the end. It's just like, just close your eyes and listen. It sounds like Jennifer Aniston. You know, like, do you ever do that with movies though?
I think I do it if I do, yeah, if I almost recognize somebody. But there's something so incredibly different and unrecognizable about their appearance that I have to kind of like look away or close my eyes and just focus on the voice. But usually the voice jumps in. Like it'll be something about, I remember first time I saw, just one example, first time I saw Shrek 2 and I heard like the fairy godmother come in and I didn't know who the voice was. And then she said, "Oh, you want to be married." And I have heard Jennifer Saunders say married before.
Married.
I was like, "Oh, it's Jennifer Saunders." Yeah, married. Then it would have been Elizabeth Taylor. But
I knew a guy once, like that I worked with. And at one point I was just sort of like, would hear him talk. And I'm just like, something is familiar there. And it was Steve Buscemi. It was just like the same fucking voice as Steve, but like in this like young, this young kid. And it's just like, why does he sound exactly like Steve Buscemi? Like people like that need to fucking work in voice acting. Like they need to get in there and do something.
Yeah, if they need a Steve Buscemi type to do a voiceover, that guy could book it. Yeah, that's the way it works.
And voice acting pays a lot of money too.
It totally. I've got to get into that. Yeah. Maybe because I don't want to act, but I mean, I do, but I don't. But voice acting, maybe I should. Yeah, I don't know. Do I have a?
Well, isn't it? There's like a lot more. There's a lot more to it because I was watching some an interview with Sarah Michelle Gellar, and she was sort of like talked about voice acting a little bit, and she's just like, you know, it's actually not as easy as you know, like people think it is.
Oh no,
because you have to. No. You know the content is already animated. You have to match like the movements of the mouth and all that. So there is a lot more to it. But I guess like the good part of it is that you don't really have to learn your lines. They're just all in front of you. So you're not going to be doing your homework the night before trying to memorize everything.
Right. No, I've looped. I did an indie film that we recorded a great deal outside of my dialogue, and they didn't want the ambient noise from the freeway nearby and everything. Mm-hmm. So I went into the recording studio, and sorry, we're way off topic here. But
that's what we do here. That's what we
do. I know.
Do here,
I just remember sitting there with the podium, you know, like in a little recording booth, and they had the screen, and they were just playing my scenes. They play like one scene. Maybe about 20 seconds of it, like on a loop, and just have me say the line over and over and over again to try and get it to sync up with, you know, what my mouth was doing on screen and also to find the performance, you know, like which take is going to sound. Do we have it? Okay, we've got it. We're going to move on to the next 20 seconds or something like that. And it was cool. It was fun. It was like a game. For a Virgo like me, it was a fun game.
Imagine how much work it is for Brad Dourif to do Chucky. What do you mean the lips didn't line up that time?
Well, they also,
you want me to do it again?
For Chucky, I think they record him first and then kind of like make, I mean, if you have to loop it later, yeah, you're probably shit out of luck. But I know that they program the lips to kind of like move at the cadence that like he's speaking the lines too. So, but I, you know, I'm sure there are instances where it's tough. Anyway,
Jake Weber, Liev Schreiber, sound alike.
The dimension that they gave his character, it happened with the killing of, we didn't name him Frank, Nicole's father. He was the one who was kind of like the force behind like, you know, this guy needs to be executed because he's a risk. And this is the seemingly most even-tempered and clear-headed guy with regard to the humanity left in this situation. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he was the one suggesting the killing of Frank before Frank can kill them, and that Anna was challenging him on this when they seemed to be kind of playing for the same team up until that point, I thought, well, that's interesting. I like that. It gives me another side of this man because he's not behaving irrationally. He just sees things a different way than Anna does. And it applied a kind of nuance that I don't think is absolutely necessary with films of this ilk, but it's refreshing when it's there because it's also, it doesn't tack on an extra hour to the movie and it doesn't need to. It's mm-hmm. just kind of like, well, what if we just, you know, tweak this moment a little bit here? And I appreciated that because also I didn't necessarily think I saw Anna's point of view and I saw his point of view and I didn't think either of them were wrong and I didn't think either of them were right.
Well, I feel like Anna in particular, like when do we really get to see her point of view after like the start of the movie? Like there's one moment where, which actually I really liked where she's kind of going like, I need to find medical equipment. And then the one, like the third security guard is like waiting outside and he's getting impatient and she's kind of in there and it's like, finally dawning on her of just, you know, her husband's dead. Her whole life has been ripped from her. Everyone she knows is probably dead. And she's just sitting there, like she's found these shoes because she's been barefoot this entire time. She's found these shoes, she puts them on and she just sort of sits down and starts sobbing for the first time.
Right.
After like kind of keeping this like strong exterior. Mm-hmm. And as soon as she starts to, the guy's like, hurry up in there. It's just like, oh, shut the fuck up. Like, yeah. You know, like she didn't even get that moment. And I feel like we don't really get anything with her. Like, you know, there's like a little bit here and there, but it's just like for the most part, she's not really the main perspective here. Like, I feel that we get more from Ving Rhames's point of view than anyone else in this movie.
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I'm also thinking about the moment where they're all sitting in the circle. I think they're around, and I want to talk about this too, but when mm-hmm. they're around hallowed grounds. And
when I saw that first, I'm like, is it called Halloween? Because I just saw the Halloween.
I know, I thought that too. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, are they just naming movies Metropolis?
Well, Halloween? If you look at the mall, it's at the exterior, and then it's also the shop where your favorite Monica is trying on lingerie. The name of the department store is called Galen Ross, who is the actress who plays Francine in the original.
Right, yeah. So I think there were...
See, that is how you do... fan service. That is an Easter egg for a remake.
Well, that's one thing that Zack Snyder has definitely developed as a director, which is microscopic symbolism and, you know, allusions and even, I guess, cameo type things.
Yeah.
He plants them throughout every project he works on. And this one, I appreciate it. Because also, sometimes it's left a little oblique. Like, it's not exactly clear what is there. And it's more about the subjectivity of it. Like, well, what does it mean to you? Not in a way that he can't explain it, but in a way that I think he delights in a kind of lack of specificity. It's like, it's more about, like, are you engulfed in this enough to, like, read something into it? Because one thing that I appreciated about... the three big ones for me were Hallowed Grounds, Metropolis, and because that was the name they kept going back to that they were like locked into originally. And then the little kid's place where the baby is, which is called Carousel. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of like, is there a significance to these? And I started wondering just because Carousel, immediately I started thinking about Logan's Run, the movie, which in a nutshell... The old people, they don't allow people to like age beyond a particular age. Like once you're old, and then you go off to Carousel, which is essentially just death. You know, they put you on a raft and they send you off, you know, poetically in a way. Like they really kill you. But so I thought like, okay, so Carousel, like that's kind of bleak and that's kind of like, you know, like it speaks to a finite end. And then I thought about Metropolis and I just thought like about the, German expressionistic silent film that is about a futuristic urban dystopia. And I thought, okay, like an urban dystopia, a mall. That makes sense. And the other one was Hallowed Grounds because that's the common area. That's the one where they can come together and have their conflict or they can come together and choose peace, you know? And so something about the grounds that they stand upon where they have their most important exchanges are all on hallowed grounds spoke to something that was much larger to them that I thought got visually represented. Yeah. One of the first things we see when Sarah Pauly, Anna is driving home is this overhead view of her car driving through her neighborhood, which suggested anonymity to me. And just, and you know, kind of like a, what you said earlier, it could happen to you. It could happen to anyone kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like she could be in, yeah. living in any of these houses and so could you. And then later, after the entrance is made by Vivian, I think, the little girl.
Yes.
The entrance, the zombie Vivian, mm-hmm. a very memorable moment in the picture. And she escapes. She's back in the car. And after she's kind of like done this loop-de-loop in her neighborhood and escaped it, she's on the, again, another overhead view of her with the pandemonium happening around her car. Yeah. And it no longer feels like anonymity. It feels more like suggesting an overwhelming yeah. world that she is, you know, just trying to make her way through.
Yeah.
And because I've already kind of identified with her as a quote unquote protagonist, I feel it's also immersive, like me being kind of like locked into this car and pushed through this world.
Did you notice the truck that there's kind of like a collision and it goes into the gas station and it blows up?
Yeah.
Cause I think that is an Easter egg from, I don't know if it's the original Dawn of the Dead or it's Night, like the original Night of the Living Dead, where the actor's name who plays the main character in Night of the Living Dead, who he like recalls some story about like seeing a like a truck fly into a gas station. So there's another bit of homage or just like Easter egg right. that's so subtle that just, you know, kind of. Again, going back to Zack Snyder and his ability to make these references and not have them be so in your face. But the, yeah, I felt like every time we were at the Hallowed Grounds, like, or around there, it just felt like everything was peaceful. Like everything was fun and jovial and like people were just kind of like, you know, they're getting along even if there was like arguments. But when we went to those other stores, it was just like, bleh. But the, you mentioned something about how it's sort of like it could happen to anyone. Mm-hmm. And I think that that really bespeaks to why this movie works so well, because you could conceivably look at Dawn of the Dead, like the universe of Dawn of the Dead, and be like, this exists in the same universe. Like maybe this is a different mall or something. You know, it's certainly different characters. We're not remaking it. But also the fact that there's tons of people in that neighborhood, in that city, in the world, where it's just like there are other Dawn of the Dead stories of survivors all over the place. And that's why I think it's such a smart decision that this was the story that they told with the remake, because it's like, we're not doing the exact same thing because there's something more interesting to tell. And I think that I've kind of, you know, as I was saying before, the most important proponent to a movie's success is the script. And, you know, whether or not did I think that this was better than the original, and I'm mm-hmm. at this point making a decision that it is, because I do remember now in the original, there's a lot of slow parts and there's a lot of just like them just sitting around and just like repeating the same emotional beats and scenes and decisions over. And there's a lot of like, they're doing stuff and we don't really like, there's exposition, a lot of exposition, and then they do things and it's like really long drawn out scenes, but nothing is happening with them in a way that like actually makes it feel like the scene is full of quality. It's just sort of like, okay, we're getting from point A to point B and it's taking a really long time to get there. Whereas I feel like with the script here, it's, you know, really the connectivity is the setting, the location. There's way more people in the movie than there's the four who are there. Like it starts off with a smaller group, but there's still more of them. And there's the security guards and you have this society essentially. And like, we're telling a different story and it's a better story. So that's why I do think that this is a better movie.
I mean, two things. Okay, so you're coming to that conclusion.
I think that Dawn, like the original, yeah. I will just say, like, it's because they're both, again, aesthetically different. You know, I really appreciate yeah. the what George Romero did with the original, like the vibe of that, like the comic booky right. look to it, because that is so special. It's so unique to that. And I think the movie is very relevant for that. But story-wise, I think this succeeds at it. And it's a nice movie to look at as well. So, you know, even more points right. in its favor.
Okay. I mean, it makes me really anxious to check out the unrated cut of this, because I remember we were on opposite sides of the spectrum with the first movie, with the first Dawn of the Dead, because I had seen a like 2.5 hour version. I don't remember how long yours was, and I saw
I think mine was the shorter one. Yeah,
yeah. And I remember having what I felt I think was a more positive reaction to that. Because, and we alluded to Zack Snyder in that pod talking, not about this movie, but about, him getting to take up more space with his, director's cuts, essentially, of, like movies like Batman v Superman and his Justice League.
Right.
And about how, like, they got, you know, in one case, a half hour of footage taken out, and in another, literally 2 hours, you know, of excess footage was taken out and replaced with like a lot of Joss Whedon stuff. Back to Buffy. But and for me, to my taste as a cinephile, the director's cut, as far as Zack Snyder is concerned with those two projects, those DC projects, was always superior to the shorter, the truncated cut that the studio wanted me to have, because there were things that he was, lines that he was drawing and symbolism he was planting and things that needed to pay off that didn't, all of a sudden didn't pay off and were meaningless and harder to kind of wrap my head around, and became so much clearer when I saw the story as he intended it. And I felt that with George A. Romero's, and I wouldn't even call it his cut, but the longest cut for me, the one that was the most behavior-based, was the one that was kind of like the most eloquently spelled out in terms of like, and also, you know, I love behavior. I love, you know, watching people just kind of occupy a space and seeing, well, what are they going to do? Yeah. How are they going to look at each other? How long is it going to take before they speak? Those nuances I can really react to.
Do you have a preference for good behavior or bad behavior?
I mean, honestly, that's an interesting question. Honestly, in this day and age, I'd say what we designate good behavior, I probably will lean into a little bit more, because there's enough bad behavior in my daily practice from other people. I roll my eyes and shake my head at so many people in my interactions throughout the day that when I can watch decency on screen, I'm really quick to cry, and I'm really quick to renew my faith because not only did somebody act that believably, but somebody wrote that, somebody, you know, produced it, and somebody wanted me to see it and to inspire me to be a better person and not, you know, be so bleak with my outlook. How about you?
Interesting. Well, I saw a post on Twitter a week back, and it was asking a question, because, I mean, I'm so much like everything I watch is horror. It's very rare that I step outside of that. But the question was, what are your four favorite movies that are not horror? And it's like, oh shit, I really have to kind of think on that. Cause like, what would I pick? And I didn't, without even thinking about it, like, you're like, in terms of like, is there like a connection between any of these? I just like went through it. I'm like, okay, The Letter, Betty Davis, 1940 movie, where she, you know, it starts off, she murders her lover, who she's having an affair with. You know, she invites her over. The movie starts off with her shooting him, and then it's like the rest of it unravels. The other one, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which we're gonna cover soon, because that is actually, it is like semi horror. It turns into a horror movie, but
it's,
you know,
camp.
Yeah, like a trio of like a rock group, a female rock group, Go to Hollywood and just get like sucked into this world of depravity. Then you've Jackie Brown, which I think is the like underrated Quentin Tarantino movie. It's my favorite. Samuel L. Jackson playing this gun runner, and Pam Grier is his, like, you know, taking the money across the border to him so he doesn't get caught. And then Jawbreaker, which we did cover on the Cherry Picker After Dark, you know, like the popular girls who accidentally murder their friends. And I'm just like, what is the common theme here? It is women behaving badly. And that is kind of my thing. Like, I love to see that. I want to see women doing wicked things. I don't know what it is, but it's just like, it, that intrigues me so much more than like, than women behaving nicely or men behaving nicely or even men behaving wickedly. Because I feel like I've seen it. There's enough of that in the real world. Like, I want to see women's stories where they're misbehaving and they're doing bad things. And like, that to me is entertaining. And then I thought about it again. I'm like, holy shit, Pam Grier is in three of those four movies. So that just like was another like explosion of mind.
Oh my God, that's awesome. No, and I, you know, and I agree in terms of that vein. I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, I love Baby Jane and I love All About Eve.
Yeah.
And I love Carrie and I love, you know, like there are tons of titles that I can speak to. But I think the thing, and you know, it's because also that's a very specific thing because I understand absolutely an appetite for women behaving badly because it also means something different. I think like, and again, we'll go off on a little tangent here, but I, like being raised as closeted gay boys, I feel like when we get to watch women kind of like own whatever power movies are willing to grant them, it's almost like gaining a secondhand thrill off of them inheriting that power and and celebrating it and manifesting it and not being afraid. That's what we want to do. Yeah. That's what we strive for. So I totally get that because behaving badly from any kind of, what sort I'm looking for? Marginalized community on screen can often equal freedom, can often equal equality, and can often equal an opportunity to do something that society won't grant you. So I agree with that.
There is a level of freedom behind, and this is in both the original and this movie, where it's just like, we're starting over. We make up the rules here. And it's just sort of like, and that, and it's interesting because we start the movie and we have the security guards and it's, there's this oppression about them and just how like the main guy, I can't even remember his name, but because he's just like, nobody's going to be stealing anything. And it's like, who cares? The world is over. Like, just, you know, like you're making this your home now. You have free run of just everything here. And, you know, it was nice when they finally just like took it back from them. And they're just like, we're just going to have everything we have. And like, even in that montage and, you know, why I, you know, to explain why, like I glom to those characters, like the bouncy blonde Monica, who behaves badly because here she is. She's like stealing. I mean, she's not stealing at this point, but she's, you know, trying on the lingerie. She's just like, you know, taking advantage of this. She's hooking up with this guy who, you know, like maybe in the real world is just like, I would never hook up with that guy. But since we're here, it's like, why not? Like the wheel has been reinvented. Let's do that. And that's why I like characters like that.
That's why I think maybe I didn't cotton to this Monica as much as you did, because it makes me think about Heather from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the new
Heather
generation.
Face, yeah.
Heatherface, yeah. Who you know I adore. And that character...
Adriana Daddario, is that...
Sure.
Yeah.
And that... But that character... The thing about that character that I adored was the fact that, like, she was as vapid as they come, as selfish and self-absorbed, and
Alexandra, and sorry.
And, okay. Yeah. And had a lot... Thank you for that. And also had, like, a bevy of opportunities to kind of, like, you know, maybe be heroic, but opted really just to kind of lean into... well, keep me alive. I just want to survive. And even that, I was like rooting for her because this is the thing. And we said this as much when we covered the franchise months and months and months and months ago.
Yeah, years.
That she has a point of view that though I don't agree with it, I am thoroughly entertained by it because it is the same way you said it. It's so kind of like unfiltered and undeniably her. Like at least she's being upfront about it. But the thing is, I don't feel like it's to the detriment of anybody else. It's just her being who she is. I think once being who you are is a detriment to other people, that's when you start to lose me. And I don't think Monica's being who she was a detriment to anybody, but it would have been nice, like I was saying, talking about this hallowed ground moment when they're all kind of like in the circle talking about what they, we just kind of catch them in the middle of this exchange that appears to be them discussing what they're best at and what they were worst at in, you know, the before times. Mm-hmm. And it comes to Michael and he says that he was worst at being a husband. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh wow. And it's all kind of like good natured and chuckling and everything like that, even though it seems very true. And then they ask him, I think Anna is the one who asked him, so what were you best at? And he says, oh, it kills me. He says, I was best at being a father. And everyone just sits quietly with it. And you just kind of see them all, and not all of them. I really wish there could have been, I don't, maybe there was a take on Monica, but it just didn't resonate with me. Mm-hmm. Even if she would have been rolling her eyes, at least that would have been something. I think she just needed more screen time. Mm-hmm. But what I really, really responded to, and another thing that kind of like, it was another check mark for me in the plus column for, say, someone like Nicole. When he said that, she's just lost her father. And mm-hmm. I see the ground kind of open up before her. She just kind of goes to that place like, mm-hmm. you know, like, I had a good father, you know. And it just kind of was like, wow, I wasn't expecting this. This, I mean, it. If you blink, you miss it, but yeah. it's some depth. If you're looking for it, it's a scrap of depth, and I really appreciated that. I would have liked a smidge of that for Monica.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think, and that's a point to make for both Dawn of the Deads, is that there is depth, there is humanity there, and that's, you know, that's kind of the core of what the movies are. But yeah, I mean, there's only so much time. I mean, we're... You know, if I were to go over the entire movie and you know, make the Zach Cherry Zack Snyder cut and cut out like, okay, well, we don't really need this, but like, let's try to get more of this character in here or this character. I'm sure I could do that, but I mean,
there's definitely
moments that might lull a little, but there wasn't enough that it like was a detriment to the overall experience.
No, and as much as I admire the contrast, because I think there's a lot of bombast in the opening of the original one, and then there's a lot of, consequently, silence, moments of silence in the original. And I love the balance between the explosiveness and the stillness, but I also really admire the stride. I feel like this one keeps a stride going forward. I don't really feel, even in the still moments, like I said, blink and you miss it. Like, it has an intention. It's inexorably moving forward. Mm. And I admire that as much as I do the tone that George A. Romero introduced in his movie.
If I did have a complaint, just in terms of like the forward momentum of things, it just seemed like it was really easy and almost like, it was almost like a bit of a contrivance that, like, all of a sudden, okay, we got to get out of here and we can do this and we can get to the boat and all that. Like, it didn't feel like it was set up very well. And I think maybe a lot of that is predicated on the fact that we do have that character, who you hate. I forget is the Ty Burrell character. Cause we don't really, he says like, oh, I've got a boat and yada, yada, yada. But I wasn't feeling the threat of like, we need to go now. It wasn't until like, because they had planned it, but then like they were coming out of the basement and like, okay, we're doing this now. We've moved it up, but it didn't feel like enough of a shift for them to an action that was caused to create this consequence where, okay, this is what we're going to do next. It was almost like, oh, by the way, there's this, we could do that. Whereas like in the original, you have like most of the movie, they're building this utopia for themselves. They're content staying there. They're like, we can stay here as long as possible. She's pregnant. They're going to bring their child up here. And then this biker gang comes in and they just fuck shit up. And then it's like, okay, now we have to go. And I didn't necessarily need them to be like, we're going to camp out here forever, but I would have appreciated maybe something that like, you know, just like an urgency, something that like, we're going to do this as a consequence of everything. Cause it just seemed like the baby, when that happened, it was just like, it almost like that's where they made the decision. We're going to get out of here. And that happening didn't really affect anything. It was just like, okay, we lost three people here and the baby is a zombie and we had to like put them down, but it didn't really like, they could have just continued doing what they were doing. Like, unless I missed something, it didn't feel like there was any urgency to move on, because like, that to me is not a good strategy. Like, they were holed up in a good place. why would they risk it and try to go anywhere else at that point?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because I feel like probably my broadest, I don't even know if it's a complaint, but it's something that I noticed. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily bother me, because I think the movie works well. That said, one thing that I really appreciated about George A. Romero's incarnation is the fact that it was set at a mall. It gets discussed often. We covered it thoroughly in our discussion, I think. Mm-hmm. About, you know, corporate America, and about, you know, materialism and capitalism and commercialism and whatnot. And what you put zombies just kind of like banging, you know, dumbly up against, you know, these glass walls that they can't break. And they kind of become no longer a threat. It actually becomes kind of like a thing you still kind of look back to and wonder about, is there humanity left in them? And, you know, and there's a lot of room for the characters to wonder, for the audience to wonder, and time, you know, like, George A. Romero takes that time. With Zack Snyder's, as much as I like it, I didn't understand why, outside of the fact that it's a remake, why it needed to take place in a mall at all. It could kind of take place anywhere It could be in a warehouse. It could be in, I don't know. It could be in a gymnasium that has like access to a cafeteria in a high school or something like that. Like they could pretty much be anywhere, as long as they have food and facilities and access to water and, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So I feel like that symbolism, that layer, was kind of missing for me. It's like I said, it wasn't enough for it to like completely spoil the broth or anything like that. And there were just like a few critiques on the tail of it, like toward the end. Like, I was really enjoying myself, and then we just got to the point where logistically some things I was like, well, that kind of doesn't make sense. Like when Michael was taking CJ and Bart. Was it Bart? Yeah, it was Bart.
Okay.
Because they needed to find the generator to get the power back on.
Right.
And so CJ and Bart have been like basically incarcerated this entire time against their will. And now they're being let out because they're the ones who know where the generator is, because they already kind of planted the seed that Terry wouldn't know, because he's the newest. So, you know, how would he know where the generator is and everything? But I didn't understand, okay, why is Michael taking them logistically alone to the two of them? He's outnumbered. And why is he just like kind of trusting them, like trusting that when he says, no, you're coming with me, I'm not going to just let you stay here. They could easily overpower him. Like, it's an afterthought that all of a sudden Kenneth, the cop, is kind of like there with his own gun and just kind of like, I'm going with you. Like, no, you mean you're coming with us? It's like, why is this not part of the plan? Why are we even wasting time with this? And why? That was like a logistical thing that I was just kind of like, hey, that doesn't exactly make sense. We didn't even need that. Like, just show me the two of them, like the two captives and the two guys with their guns with the captives. And I know, okay, everything's copacetic. We're fine. That was one thing. And the other was just simply the isolation between Luda and Andre. And the way it was just kind of dismissed in a time where people could get bit and conceal it. Mm-hmm. And first thing they're going to do if they're trying to conceal their bite is hide themselves.
Yeah.
And they're just kind of like, oh, well, that's fine. Whatever. Nobody suspected anything until the discovery was made. Like, that, literally didn't suspect
that
anything.
That really felt like it was glossed over. Like, in that scenario, which, I mean, if I was going to make an excuse for it, it's just that sort of, that was the power shift there, where it's like you would have had the characters like the CJ and the Bart. Thank you for reminding me of their names. Where that would never fly, and it's just showing that like they weren't wrong, but that the crowd that came wasn't wrong either. You know, they both had a point of view that was important and should have been listened to, because if the CJ and all that, they got a say in what was going on, they'd be like, absolutely not. They're not going to segregate themselves somewhere else. We need to know what's going on at all times. We need to check on things. Where it's like, now that, like, you know, with people like Anna running the show, where it was just sort of like, yeah, let's, you know, lackadaisical, let's let everyone do their own thing. We're not really going to focus on it and be like, how's Luda doing? I haven't seen her in a while. Like, maybe someone who was more scrutinizing of shit like CJ would have been like, why haven't we seen her in a while? Like, what's going on there? That whole scenario where could have been avoided, where two people unnecessarily were killed, or one person at least, because it seemed like Mekhi Phifer. I still know what you did last summer, by the way, was he was going to be do whatever the fuck he was going to do. What was his line when right before he died? And I still know what you did last summer. It's like he's like, I'm hungry, I'm fucking horny, and so, like it was just like this out of nowhere.
You would remember better than I would.
That well, that felt like that would have been your quote at the beginning of that episode.
I don't even remember what I said. What did I say?
I don't know. It's probably like
there is no man with a hook. But no, I mean, it's interesting because I mean again, they didn't spoil it for anything. Like the movie's got a movie, so I understand. But it did like kind of like play on the plausibility of it all. But at the same time, by then, those two choices were actually made back to back. So I wonder if I don't know. I did wonder if like in the unrated cut, if maybe I was missing something that made it make more sense.
No, I think that it's just not. There's just not enough connectivity. Like there should have been more questions, or because you have these characters on both sides, there should have been like an event or something that just played out, or someone to even a look, just some sort of beat, because it does feel very disconnected in a way. And I feel like a lot of like that though, like the Luda and sorry, what's his name?
Andre.
It was almost like they were in their own movie at a certain point. Cause I remembered, that's the one thing I actually remember about the movie the most was them and that whole situation. Yeah. I don't remember how it played out, but I remembered that. Cause especially when you see her with her big pregnant belly at the beginning, you're just like, that ain't gonna go well. I remember that shit goes wrong. I forgot at what point in the movie it happened. Like I thought it was much earlier, but it actually, you know, carried out well past the halfway point. So I think it was just a matter of, it wasn't integrated as well as it could have been into the story. And who knows what it was. I mean, early film in Zack Snyder's career, and I don't know about James Gunn, but, had they maybe been more seasoned, they could have worked around that better. And even in some cases not, because, more seasoned writers and directors are kind of victims of studio interference. It might have even been worse if, a Dawn of the Dead was made in this day and age. But I mean, to answer the whole thing about the being set in the shopping mall, I agree. Like there's not really, the mall isn't as much a character in this movie as it was in the original.
Right.
That it could have been set anywhere. And I think that again goes back to the idea that this Dawn of the Dead could be anywhere. Like there's groups of survivors all over the place. I think that was just a way to connect it to the original. Just be like, this is a remake. It's set in a mall. That's what the original was about. And I don't mind it. I think it's fine. But yes, there's probably more of an exploration of that mall that we could have done. We could have seen more of like, and maybe that's where you can incorporate characters like the Monica into it. It's just like, other than just seeing a quick little montage of just like lingerie and, things like that, actually get more of a sense of like, we're rebuilding society in our own mall here, stuff like that with these characters. And maybe they just chose not to do it because like, if they want to see it, they can go watch the original. We're not telling that story. We don't need to see the same thing here. There's something way more like high octane action about this movie. And not to say that the original didn't have its action moments, but it was certainly, there's a lot more downtime in the original. Whereas here, it just feels like it's constant go, go, go. There's always some shit happening that the downtime is very few and far between.
I gotta say, like I kept thinking like, what do I remember about this movie before I went into it? And I thought, okay, certainly I remember Vivian entering as a little girl zombie, and I remember the shock that I felt in the theater in particular, because I didn't know these zombies were going to run. So when she started running, it was like, ah! I think I screamed out loud with my sister, who has a zombie-like phobia. She hasn't been diagnosed or anything, but that when you ask, like, what are you most scared of? She'll be like, zombies and snakes. But so I remember that vividly. I also remember, like you mentioned, I will never forget The little zombie baby that's being kept secret, and you know, the pregnant wife and everything like that. That whole scenario, because I remember being really pissed the first time I saw it, not at the movie, but at Andre for being so, you know, it's so stupid to put it this way. I was so mad at him for being so crazy because he's just kind of like, "You're gonna kill my family." It's like, "Bitch, it's not your family."
It's like, and all then, of a sudden he turned into Vin Diesel.
Yeah, right. It's a Fast and Furious movie all of a sudden. Yeah. But also, the other thing that I remembered that actually I want to speak just to like the special effects for a second, because it only heightened my admiration for the way Zack Snyder attacked this movie as a director, was after Michael and Kenneth move with CJ and Bart into the parking garage to get to the generator and everything like that. And they find the dog. They find Chips is his name.
Okay, Chips. But did I say Skip? Yeah. Close enough.
I think so, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
You meet a guy named Chip. You can call him Skip. He won't get that mad. but don't do it. I'm kidding. But anyway, but I remember being shocked at that moment when the overhead zombie, you know, was like kind of like not straddling, but I guess, what do you call it?
Like, he didn't have any legs.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. I remember the first time I saw it, I was shocked just by the visual. And I thought like, wow, that's amazing. Oh, that's great CGI too. Like, I mean, I probably because it was so dimly lit and because it's so fast moving. But God, that moment worked on me, I thought, as I left the theater. And then I remember when I bought the DVD not long thereafter, and I watched the special effects, you know, the special features. And they showed the making of that particular scene. And they showed the amputee stuntman who was playing that zombie.
Oh, wow.
And was literally, there was no CGI involved. They did it practically in camera. They just gave him the little tendrils, you know, that were hanging from his stumpy legs. And he, you know, had a wire that was keeping him safe, you know, as he kind of not straddled, but like monkeyed, you know, across that, that pipe. And then, and you just watch them like doing the takes, like, you know, the setups and the takes and talking to the performer and everything. And I was like, oh my God, this guy's a genius. Because it didn't even enter my mind. And also I realized kind of like for, it was a wake up moment for me as an audience member, how jaded I was becoming to what I was seeing and how easily I was dismissing, you know, well, that's clearly not real because you can't do that. And it's like, no, you can. You can, and it's actually a lot cheaper than CGI, and it's more creative and more effective. Like, that's why it is so effective, is because he did it practically. And I really admire that moment. I always think about it when I think about this movie.
Do you want to guess what the budget is for Dawn of the Dead 04?
Oh, Jesus. I don't know. What was a typical budget for a movie then? Like,
I mean, well, mid-range budgets were more common back then. And actually, this is a thing that I've come to discover. What I actually think is that the 2000s destroyed the mid-range budget movie, because I was watching one, I don't know if we're ever going to cover this on the podcast. I hope not. But I was watching Vacancy for the first time in a really long time.
I remember that movie. It was awful.
Because, I did it for my Patreon review. I do a movie every month that the Michael and Ghostface Cheers nominate, and then it's voted on. And that was the one that won. And I was watching it, and I was just, wow, you know, I had the same kind of reaction. I'm just like, this is like, it made The Strangers look like a great movie to me, like just a point of comparison. But I was so curious. I went and I looked at the budget, and it was $19 million. And I'm just like, abso-fucking-lutely. Like, most of that probably went to Kate Beckinsale and Luke Wilson, but it was just like $1 million could have been like, that's what that would be made for today, but 19 at the time. And I think we talked about this with Joyride and stuff, and it was just like, it got to a point where these movies were so expensive where they didn't have to be, and it brought these studios to a place where they are now. It's just like, no, we're not gonna make mid-range budget movies. Like, if we can't do it for under five, we're gonna do it for over 100 or something like that. And sorry, getting back to Dawn of the Dead. Dawn of the Dead's budget was $26 million, which is very, like, I was expecting a lot more. I feel like it could be done for even less, like much less, mm-hmm. like just given what it was, especially if they were using more practical methods. Mm-hmm. But still, like, that's pretty low for what, like, a lot lower than what I would expect, I guess, yeah. you know, especially since Zack Snyder wasn't Zack Snyder yet. Yeah. But just comparing that to Army of the Dead, the projected budget was between 70 and 90 million for that
movie. Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah. The budgets don't, like, big budgets aren't gonna make better movies, folks. Like, no. I mean, I know that I'm preaching to the choir, like, you know, you have already, everybody who's listening to this knows that.
Yeah.
and, yeah. But, like, if you know somebody who runs a studio, just send them to the pod, and I know that what we're saying is gonna make all the difference.
Well, the box office for Dawn of the Dead remake was $102 million. So it was a success, for
sure. And
that
was just domestic, or was that worldwide?
I'm assuming, I'm just looking at the Wikipedia one, so I'm assuming that's worldwide.
They usually indicate on IMDb.
Yeah, it usually is. But yeah, still, like, there's but a lot of those movies, like, this is a good example of that. But, like, I think Vacancy was like $19 million. It might have done 25 or, you know, something like that. So not mm-hmm. very much. Let me actually look at that specifically, because I'm interested. Since I'm talking about it, everyone should know anyway. 35. So
okay.
So 19 million budget, 35. Like, that is pushing it, because, like, then you've got your marketing budget in there as well, and
mm-hmm.
and if the exhibitors, you know, keep half or whatever the formula is, it's. You know, it's, you know, that's why these studios are just like, well, we can't make movies that expensive anymore. That's why it's like things are so limited nowadays.
Yeah. I also was curious, just because I mentioned, like, you know, my response to the Running Zombies here, which were starting to trend around this time. I know this movie was preceded by 28 Days Later.
Yes.
Which came out in 2002. And anxious to revisit that one too. That's one.
Well, they're doing a third one now.
Yeah.
Yeah. 28 years later with
my God,
with your favorite Killian.
He's okay. I mean,
I'm joking, because I remember when we did the red iPod.
I had a much more antithetical. Or is that the word I'm looking for? Like a yeah.
And he's now an Oscar winning actor since then. So, you know, he's.
That was leveled. Shit.
He's
good
leveled.
For him. I was happy for him. When he won, I was like, yay!
Did you see Oppenheimer?
No, I still have yet to see Oppenheimer.
I've yet
or
to
Barbie.
See
Barbie. I haven't seen either of them.
You haven't seen Barbie?
I have not done the Barbenheimer yet,
no. Yeah. I mean, Barbie is not really, that's not in my wheelhouse. I did see it. I was just like, okay. Like, I didn't personally find it funny. But I am interested in Oppenheimer. Like, the thing is, it's like a 3-hour movie, which I guess
I know.
Now that my options are more like watch at home on streaming, that's
yeah
more accessible to me, because I hate going to the theater and sitting there for that long.
Well, that's the thing. I would have loved to see it in IMAX, but then I heard all of the news stories about, like, the projectors kept breaking because it was a 3-hour movie in IMAX, and you're not supposed to do both, either do a 3-hour movie or do it in IMAX, because IMAX, it has to be on film. They don't do it, like, just, you know, digitally or whatever. Like,
I
it
never
has to.
Heard that.
They kept breaking the projectors out here. Like, and I was like, I'm not going to spend
the
my
the
money.
The bomb, like, ended up breaking everything down.
I'm not going to spend my money and carve out time in my day to, you know, sit for over 3 hours, because, you know, you've got all the trailers too beforehand.
Yeah.
And then have it just break on me. So I held out. Now, who knows? But anyway.
Yeah.
I was curious.
But yeah, 28, see, like, 28 days.
But see, this is the thing.
Yeah.
I wanted to know, like, is there anything that predated it? And I went to one site called stackexchange.com that cited Life Force in 1985 had running undead, maybe not zombies, but running undead people in it. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. And then just a few months later.
I saw Life Force.
Yeah, like a while. I think we did it for the old pod.
No, we didn't, but we talked about it, because it was a blind buy for me. It's Toby Hooper, and I was just like, this movie wasn't it for me. Like, very science fiction.
No, it wasn't it for me either. Yeah. So okay, we talked about it, but yeah. I Yeah, that one. And then a few months later, Return of the Living Dead came out, and that had some running zombies in it. And that was also 1985. But I was curious. I was like, you know, I wasn't satisfied. I wanted to know, like, you know, are there any Reddit threads? And I did go down kind of a hole, finding that apparently in Umberto Lenzi in 1980 released a movie called Nightmare City that had also running zombies in it. And some people even cite, they're not undead, but there's a movie in 1971 called I Drink Your Blood, which was people with rabies that have a zombie affectation to them, and they run. And it was also one of the first movies to be credited or kind of like touted as a movie that was influenced by Night of the Living Dead.
Well,
and
the thing with the zombie subgenre is that I think it kind of was dormant for a very long time. Because it was big in the like 70s, and I mean, obviously it started way before that with like Night of the Living Dead, and there's like a lot of like Hammer and European stuff, and then like the 80s especially. But there was the remake of Night of the Living Dead, and that was 1990. And I think at that point, like, there's probably some movies here and there that were zombie movies, but for the most part, it was, you know, pretty dormant until 28 Days Later came out. And that sort of, even if it wasn't the first to have running zombies, like, it had them in a way that was like very aggressive. Like, it just like, it was like shocking. Cause it was like, it was like rabid zombies just like rushing you. And it's just like, especially with like the quick editing of the whole thing. And 28 Days Later, like, that kind of, you know, begat the Resident Evil and and Dawn of the Dead remake, and just like kind of spiraled into where it is now. And I think it's cooled off. Has anything like zombie-esque come out recently?
I mean, the thing is, I feel like Walking Dead dominated the market for so long that, like, I think everybody else was worried. If it did, there was one that came out a few years back that was the comedy. Wasn't it Jim Jarmusch? I can't remember the name of it right now. It had a bunch of stars in it too. It had like Adam Driver and everything like that.
I vaguely know what you're talking about. I don't know what it was called, but maybe 5 years, 4 or 5 years ago at this point. But, Walking Dead, I fell out of that like around season 5. You talk to a lot of people, like, because everyone watched Walking Dead. But the question is, at what point did you stop watching Walking Dead? Because there's so few people that were like, I stuck through it the entire series. And I feel like that probably, it just like, it was zombie fatigue when and isn't there still, like, there's spinoffs to it as well. Yeah. Like, there's
The Walking Dead and something else.
It was like, it was the Disney Plus, like, MCU show that was like that version of it before Disney Plus came out, where it's just like too much. But in 2002, and this is more so like the gamers, because there was Resident Evil the video game, the first one came out, I believe it was 96, and then they remade it for the GameCube. And that's the version, that's the first time I ever played it. And it's stunning. I still love going back and playing it. But they incorporated a thing into it, because the zombies in that like move very slow, like they typically would. And it's not until like the later sequels where they started to like, it was more like undead or like, you know, dead bodies infected by parasites. It was the faculty, you know, running at you. But in this remake that they did for it, there was a thing where you had like a thing of kerosene and a lighter. And once you killed the zombie, you had to burn them so they wouldn't come back. Because if you left them, you would come back to that stage later on in the game, and they would evolve and get up, and they would chase after you, and they would move fast. And that came out in 2002. So it was around the same time as 28 Days Later. So I feel like that might have, you know, I don't know which came first, but I mean, it's just the same ideas like happening at the same time that kind of inspired this. And I think that, you know, the fact that you have these zombies who are moving fast like that is a threat, because, you know, in the year 2000 and whatever, when you go back and you look at Night of the Living Dead and the original Dawn of the Dead and all that, the zombies are really just like, you just push them over, move past them. I think there's even a line in the remake of Night of the Living Dead where that movie's version of Barbara is like, she's looking out the window and she's just like, they're moving so slow. We can just walk around them. And it's like, of course. And I think like that's where they realize, like, if we're going to kind of this, if this subgenre is going to evolve, there has to be a threat. They have to be scary. You know, we have to know that, like, they're going to plow through us and kill us. And that just wasn't sure. happening with the old version of what the zombies were.
So in your opinion, you like your zombies aggressive and proactive.
I mean, basically. I don't really like zombie movies are not really my go-to. Like, I'm not.
Your preference.
Yeah. I mean, not that I don't enjoy them. I think that there's some that are really great, but I mean, you know, I have my things that I like and you know, zombie movies are not top tier for me.
Right. Number one, just in case anybody's like going out of their mind because we didn't cite it, Jim Jarmusch's movie was called The Dead Don't Die. Mm. And I remember reacting really positively to it. It had Bill Murray and Tilda Swinton and, as previously said, Adam Driver, because it had, just a completely different tone to it. Like, it didn't seem, it had like a lovely kind of small town, quirky kind of community reaction to the zombies. Mm. And it's not like they weren't a threat, but it was like, it was just as funny as it was kind of profound. Yeah. But, I liked that spin. But I think I have to say I prefer my zombies slow moving because the aggressive ones just, it doesn't even feel like a zombie anymore. It feels like a rabid dog, you know? Mm-hmm. It feels like, may as well be Cujo, you know, running at you instead of like a person who's the undead. But I also think there's something to the fact that they are so slow moving that you can kind of drop your guard and that, like, you're, the essential flaw in a world like that is dropping your guard and becoming kind of not placid, but I guess placid or content, like just, you know, like unassuming enough that you just kind of like no longer see the risk, and then they get you. That's how they get you. Mm-hmm. Is you drop your guard, because I think that there's something about the symbology behind just undead people, like of zombies. The word zombie itself is something we refer to as people who are just kind of moving through their lives with no direction and no passion and no connection with anything outside of like the survival, you know? Yeah. So you're already kind of become a zombie while alive is to be susceptible to becoming a zombie, you know, in actuality. To, I don't know, there's something about that that I respond to. Mm-hmm. And also because it's less of a threat. It is less of a threat, but it's more of a symbolic threat, a social threat.
I wonder what that version of Cujo would be if it wasn't like a rabid bat or whatever, but it was zombies instead. All right, I'll get your daddy.
Oh my God. Yeah. Margaret Hamilton stars in Cujo. Yeah. Or Dee Wallace. Yeah. I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog.
Anything else you want to say?
We still got to
kill some people. So
yeah, that's true. That's true. So yeah. I mean, I'll just say I took a lot of notes. If anybody isn't satisfied with what we've offered, get in my DMs. I'll tell you more. But
awesome. Okay, well, with that said, let's get to the cherry picker.
It's not like they killed them. On purpose.
Okay, cherry on top. What are your thoughts?
That's hard. I mean, I'm almost tempted to say somebody like CJ just because I didn't need the character to be redeemed, even though he kind of is. But what made him more interesting was that, like, when it came down to when the shit hit the fan, he was better than Bart in that he could actually kind of, like, you know, become part of the group. And he went down a Viking, like, you know, he went down like a badass, like, okay, I'm not just going to take myself out before you can get to me. I'm going to take all of us out with a giant explosion.
You know what? I'm fine with that, especially considering that, you know, what I said earlier about the factions and how nobody was really wrong in a sense or right. Yeah. But it's just like, had he been allowed to at least be acclimated into the group rather than locked away, it, you know, it might have prevented some shit. And I think that that is a testament to him. The only other option I could see was like maybe Chips, I guess, you know. We've done the dogs before, but
we have a single white female for sure.
Yeah. Another scenario where it's just like everyone kind of sucks, but they're also kind of cool at the same time. So I don't know.
I did. Yeah. I would never look at CG and go, oh, like Chips doesn't make any mistakes. And Chips survives actually the entire movie because none of those zombies are going to eat
Chips. Well, Chips is the final boy because, I mean, I'm assuming that they're dead at the end.
I hope they are.
That's
another thing that I remember too. Yeah. The end credits, just the "I have a red door and I want it painted black."
Yeah. What was with that head that they found in the cooler?
I wondered about that too. I was like, was that the girl, the bikini girl? It couldn't have been because
no, it was a different.
He wouldn't have just left her.
Oh, that's that's another story. He murdered her and put her head in a cooler and then went back to land and was in whatever that church thing was. That ended up there.
He's got a lot of skeletons in his closet. Yeah. Okay, so.
All right, so.
I'm in favor of Chips, actually, since he's final boy.
Well, we said CJ, so it's.
Okay.
That was really a one-off. Maybe two. I can't remember if we did it again. But, okay, so. Cherry picker results last week. We asked you who deserves to die the most in April Fool's Day, 1986. What are their names anyway? I nominated Rob Ferris, I think his name was. I don't have it written down here. You nominated Harvey something.
Was that his name?
Harvey. It was like Harvey something Jr. or Hal.
Oh, right. Yeah, that guy.
Oh, here they are. Yeah, I have it right here. Rob Ferris and Harvey Edison Jr. Right.
Call me Hal. He kept telling everybody to call him Hal the whole time.
Hal. Yeah, no, Hal. If someone like that was just like, call me Hal, I'm going to be like, okay, Harvey. I like Harvey better than Hal.
But it's his name.
His name is Harvey.
He's the one who wants to be called Hal. It's easier to just entertain it for me. Like, I'm just like, okay, fine. I'll call you whatever you want.
Do you ever eat at Harvey's? You know, like the burger joint?
I don't even.
Is that, that must be a Canadian thing.
Probably. I don't know what it is. Harvey's maybe it's in the Midwest or up north.
Hamburger, a beautiful thing.
I have no idea what you're talking about. Is it like Subway? What is it like?
No, it's like, they're like really delicious. They had like the best pickles. They must be around still. I don't know. There's like. Fewer and far between, but it was like this. It was like my mom's favorite burger joint. So we'd always go there. Like we're going to Harvey's, but then afterwards, it was just like there's something about their meat. It's just like it tastes good, but then afterwards, it's like you have this terrible aftertaste that just sticks to the top of your like the roof of your mouth. So every time I think of Harvey's, I always think of like Harvey's burgers.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I guess it's Canadian. Yeah.
If it's out here, I've never heard tell of it. And I'm in a major city, so
Well, I mean, you got a lot of those chains that aren't really up here either, so. Okay. Anyways, sure. Here we go.
In and out.
Wait, we're like really tangent-y here today.
We
are. So, Rob Ferris or Harvey Edison Jr. / Hal, based on Patreon, Instagram, and YouTube votes, the total was 95 for Rob versus 272 for Harv. Not a lot of people showed up for this one. I guess maybe it's not as popular or as well-traveled a movie. But
no surprise there, quite honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoyed it more this particular screening, but I'd understand. I'm not going to go like, what? You guys haven't seen this? Like, it's see it if you want. That's how I feel.
Yeah, yeah. Amethyst Frost. Most of the men in this movie blended together for me and looked like they came from the same 80s preppy brunette model factory. But I do remember Rob crying about his counselor saying he'd never be a doctor and wondered why that drama was even in the movie. Chop him.
Right.
Chop him.
That's funny.
Blue Box 87. Any vote that's not Amy Steele is correct, but I'm giving my vote to Rob Ferris because of that hair, even if he is bulging around during the movie.
Oh.
Sean Princick. I never heard of this one until it was mentioned during the Bodies, Bodies, Bodies pod. I guess it did come up. Thanks for the recommendation. Amy Steele is an absolute legend. Mm-hmm. She is. Michael Vasquez, yeah. Harvey Edison Jr.
Okay.
Thomas Baker, I pick Harvey.
Thank you.
And Silent Saturn. Yeah, I'm not going to vote for Rob, whose tidy whiteys and tiny blue shorts largely carry me through the movie. Come on, Zach, get your priorities in order. So by default, Harvey it is. No, I already expressed very clearly and vehemently that my crush, my April Fool's, or April Fool, as yeah. Muffy says it in the movie. My April Fool boyfriend was not Biff.
Yeah, Tom Wilson.
Arch,
as interpreted by Thomas F. Wilson.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, he's adorable.
And I share that. We would be vying for the same guy.
I would take him in like he could wear like a huge fucking parka or whatever. I would take him over that Rob dude and his tidy whities any day. The guy who went on to be Jennifer Aniston's like painter boyfriend in Leprechaun, who had the we paint in red, blue, yellow, not even like different shades. It's like kindergarten red, yellow,
it's
blue.
It's such a point of contention for you.
I know.
You always bring it up.
I know. Anyway, you've got first dibs of the Dawn of the Dead.
I have the floor.
Yeah.
All right. This was pretty easy for me, and I know you're not going to choose this person. I'm choosing Steve. He's getting the chop because, as previously stated, the one weak redeemable quality about the man. Is too little too late as far as I'm concerned. It's the bare minimum. It doesn't really cross the finish line in the way of even granting dimension, let alone redemption. And I don't need redemption. I just need like do something. And then he did, and I was like, oh, good for you. Contributing, and that's the most frustrating thing is honesty that contributes nothing. I think honesty comes with great honesty comes great responsibility. And, because there is power in honesty, and that's why I adore, and we, you know, you can watch those After Dark pods where we discuss Buffy in depth, because when Cordelia is that voice in the room, or when Anya is that voice in the room, even when Spike is that voice in the room, rarely when Xander is that voice in the room.
Because Xander's honesty is just like in his own world of
well, sometimes honesty. No, but sometimes there were times that I could get by. I know you don't, but there were times when I could, and then other times where I totally sided with you, and I was like, yeah, I'm not. This is just personal for you. You're just you know being a piece of shit. But anyway. I like this guy less than Xander. Let's put it that way. I think he's less redeemable because this is the thing. Even being honest about your douchery, if that's what you're going to do with it, that bears very little validation for you as a person in my eyes. I don't think like, well, at least you're honest about it. That is worn out. It's been, this movie is 20 years old, and that the age of that should just be like dispensed with. Let's just stop going like, yeah, he's a douche, but that's who he is. It's not a defense. And yeah, everything that I said, I'm not charmed, but I'm neither charmed. But I love Ty Burrell. This is the least I've liked him on screen. There you go.
I'm sure he won't take it personally. Sure. I'm going with evil Vin Diesel. Oh, that kind of rhymes. Andre. Because he's that trope in all of these movies. Like, he's not even bitten, but he's hiding something. And I hate those people. They're like, they're the worst of the worst. Because it's just like, great, we know that you're going to fuck it up. And of course you fuck it up. And he just fucks it up in the most selfish, irrational way. And I liked that lady that he shot. I don't think that she acted very rationally in that situation either. She should have just booked it out of there and went and told everyone.
Norma, yeah.
And then went back. But she just like, okay, fuck. gonna shoot. She did not read the room properly, but
she took him out though. Like
she took him out. She did what she had to do, but it was just like, it was such a waste. Like it was like that to me. Like, you know, as much as I was bitching about Nicole and just like her making the stupid decision earlier, this is a decision that at least I can understand it in a way, because it's like, you're gonna take my family away from me. You're gonna take my family.
but is that your Vin Diesel?
I don't know what the fuck. I don't know what that was. But it's just like, you're gonna make the stupidest fucking decision here. Like, you're looking at that baby. I don't know. I just I couldn't get on board with any of that shit. So kill him. Kill him.
I think you stand a really good chance of winning next week, just because that he's the character I thought I would have chose if I had my first choice. And then I rewatched the movie and I thought, I still like, I mean, mental illness isn't like something that I think is worth dying over, but, and he's obviously not well, but, and his priorities, it's not that I think they excuse the actions that he's taking. He's putting everybody at risk, but there's a certain level of protectivism that he's assuming that I'm like, I get it. I don't agree with it,
You said mental illness?
Yeah, because he's not well. He's looking at like this like undead baby, like it's his family. He's looking at his wife. And this is the thing, because also he has her tied up. Mm-hmm. For a reason. Like, it's not like he's in denial of the fact that she's turning.
I don't think that's mental illness. That's just selfishness.
It's denial taken to an extreme.
But denial is not mental illness.
No. When it's taken to an extreme, like to the point, like I call it's probably on par with whatever Norman Bates has, like the ability to move through a situation, like to kind of like perform the duties that you need to keep everything under wraps because you know it's wrong, but you do it anyway. That's got its foot. It's got one foot.
But I don't think that could be blamed on mental illness. Like that.
Okay. Well, anyway, I think he's a sick man, and I feel like he needs to be like the
wiring. He needs to be what?
He needs to be
killed,
dealt with in a no. He needs to be dealt with in a different way.
Okay, I was going to try to get you to make my argument.
No, I was not going to say that. That's why I didn't want to kill him. But I do think he's probably more memorable than my guy is. If you haven't seen Dawn of the Dead in a while, because he's the first. Like I said, he's the first one that came to mind for me. And then I watched the movie and I was like, oh no, Ty Burrell is way worse. But I hope y'all have seen the movie before you vote.
Anyway, there you have it. You can vote for Andre as the character's name, or Steve. And vote your heart, vote your conscience. You can vote on the YouTube channel community section. So if you are new to the podcast and you've enjoyed this time you've spent with us, please go ahead and subscribe and make sure to vote. And if you are new and you are... would rather listen to us, the RSS feed link is in the descriptions down below. You can do that. You can also go to our Instagram page to vote there and follow us. It's at the Cherry Picker Pod. And there's also voting on Patreon. You can head over there if you're subscribed or not and just throw an extra vote there. But we do appreciate the contributions, as said before. Social media, Edward. Where are you at?
On the things, the Letterboxd and the YouTube and the Instagram. And I haven't deleted my TikTok yet. So if you want to check out my cat. Yeah,
remember last week when you said, this is the last time I'm going to mention TikTok. And here we are.
I didn't say that. I said I'm thinking about me, Edward is Truth, one word, traditional spelling. How about you?
You can find me on my main YouTube channel, Zach Cherry, Z-A-C-K-C-H-E-R-R-Y. Instagram is at Retro Bitch Face, Letterboxd, Zach Cherry, Twitter, Zach Cherry 8. What's happening next week?
I had to find the title because I don't remember the name exactly. It's that one with the one. And I saw you. So Mute Witness.
Thank you for that. Yeah. Mute Witness, which if you want to get a head start, it is now streaming on Shudder. So go check it out there. But that's what's happening next week. Thank you for watching.